All right, would counsel for Mr. Stone, the appellant, please approach the podium to begin your argument? You can use either the center podium, which adjusts up and down, or the one closer to your table.
Sure.
Thank you. Would you state your name for the record before beginning your argument?
Certainly. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Eva Wales, and I represent appellant Corey Stone in this matter. Law enforcement found disassembled, incomplete components of a firearm in a backpack in a van. They connected that backpack to Mr. Stone, who was found at a park some distance away. The BCA required additional parts to reassemble those components and test fire them as a firearm. And no evidence at trial established that without those added parts, with the original components alone, those pieces could be assembled and fired, test fired. And so today, I'd like to focus on two of the four issues that Mr. Stone raised on appeal. First, this court should reverse his conviction because that collection of disassembled, incomplete firearm components is not a firearm under the relevant statute. And also, the court should find that the trial court erred in admitting photographs of an apparent text exchange without properly authenticating their contents.
I'm going to ask both of you this question. We have case law about inoperable guns and all kinds of guns, but not anything that's directly on point. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then it seems that maybe this should be a precedential opinion. And what would your syllabus point be? And I'll ask respondents, the state's attorney, that also.
Yes, Your Honor. I would ask this court to hold as a general rule that a collection of disassembled, incomplete firearm components is not a firearm.
And essentially, how is that different than an inoperable gun?
Yes.
Is it a subcategory of inoperable guns?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Essentially, the state needs to prove that those components are a firearm. So in Stone's situation, in this situation, we have kind of an antecedent question. Are these components a firearm? The example that we have, the primary example that we have from case law regarding an inoperable firearm, which was found to be a firearm, is Knabel. In that case, there was a missing or broken component. However, testimony established at trial that although it was inoperable in what was called a traditional sense, it could still be fired in essentially in a different way. It could still be fired. So that evidence established that, in fact, it was a firearm, collection missing a component. Here we have incomplete set, and it's disassembled. So we do have a case that, by our research, the court hasn't dealt with before, and it's not, by definition, essentially, any disassembled component group of parts would be inoperable. But that's a factual matter, and that's different from the legal matter of whether a disassembled, incomplete set is a firearm.
Well, should that be a legal question? I note your argument in the brief. Okay, here we needed a nut and a bolt, and it was put together, and it was operable. What if you just had the stock? What if you just had a couple of pieces that could not be formed? Isn't that a factual question that should go to the jury? I mean, and the Supreme Court has now said, here's the definition of firearm, and the Supreme Court has also said, better to not instruct that something is or isn't a firearm as a matter of law, better to let the jury decide that by giving the jury the definition. So, I mean, couldn't we have a procedure wherein, if it really is a case where it's like, well, this can't be put back together, then the defense would likely say, I want to move to dismiss this for lack of probable cause as a matter of law. These facts could not show that this pile of parts constitutes a firearm. But if it could, then we let the jury decide. Why wouldn't we just do it that way as opposed to having a rule of law that says if a firearm is disassembled, it's not a firearm?
First, just to clarify, the rule that I would propose would be if a firearm is disassembled and incomplete, and that's a key difference here. So an incomplete part, which is also disassembled.
But in this case, doesn't the record show that it was very easy to get the missing piece and put it together and fire it?
There was no evidence at trial regarding whether it could be fired without those missing pieces. And
but what I'm saying, the evidence did show that it was not hard to find the missing piece, put the gun together, and fire the gun.
Correct. The BCA apparently had those two missing pieces within their collection of pieces at the BCA. There's no evidence whether those pieces are commonly found on the street, for example. And it's our contention that it's the state's burden, essentially, to prove that those pieces were the incomplete group could be put together to form a firearm. In the case of Sybrant, for example, it was a non-precedential case, but gives an example in which there was a disassembled firearm. Component pieces were nearby where the defendant was sitting and actively repairing or cleaning that firearm. And again, there was testimony at trial that the major components were all close by and could easily be assembled. And that's a difference with this case.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. So if it's a legal and not a factual question, what if the missing part is the firing pin? The gun's disassembled, but the disassembled parts is the firing pin. Or the gun's disassembled, but the missing part is the bolt of a bolt-action rifle. Under your definition, so that it would be incapable of firing under any circumstances, but would still look like a firearm to just about anybody having it pointed at them. Would that be a firearm or not under your definition?
Well, Your Honor, there would need to be some sort of evidence at trial first to establish that I'm not a firearms expert, and potentially the judge is not either. I don't know if you are or not familiar with that. So that evidence at trial needs to be established by the state that these component parts can be easily reassembled to resemble a firearm. And even if it is still inoperable, we agree that thing then, which is a firearm, albeit inoperable, could still be brandished as a weapon. And those are the concerns that come from Glover, or that come from Lemire, for example, that inoperable firearm could still be brandished and threatening and so on. But if it can't be put together, and the only way to establish that is to have that testimony at trial saying, could these component pieces be put together, or would we be left with a stock over here and a bolt over here that are not going to be threatening visually?
Let me ask you this, because then that argument is sort of based on, you know, there was, and I'm not going to try to give the names of all these cases, I've read them. One case said, you know, we don't care if it's inoperable, the person who's at the other end of the gun doesn't know that, and
right,
it's frightening. Well, then a defense attorney argued in another case, well, given that it's about, you know, displaying the gun, you shouldn't be guilty of a crime unless you actually use the gun and display the gun. And the Supreme Court said, oh, no, you don't have to display the gun. Having it's enough. So although at first I thought, well, there is some merit to it's not put together, it can't be brandished as a gun, but the Supreme Court seems to have said it's not necessary to brandish it as a gun. It's just that you have it. It's just the possession alone. You don't have to use the gun.
So I believe that you're referring to Lemire and perhaps a couple cases following that, saying that an instrument which could be brandished as a firearm is still a firearm. Is that and is your point that they're saying it could be brandished but doesn't necessarily have to be brandished?
Have to be. Right. So that, you know, the argument, well, this couldn't be put together, so it couldn't be brandished, therefore it's not a gun, seems to run up against that line of cases saying, well, you don't have to brandish it to make it a gun.
Well, I believe if the court considers that, it's really heading down a slippery slope. And at what point, we need some boundaries. Some boundaries need to be set to say, okay, if there is just a barrel alone.
But that brings me back to my first question. Haven't we set those boundaries, or can't we set the boundary by simply agreeing that we now have a working definition of firearm from the Supreme Court? That definition gets applied to the particular facts of a case, whether it's a pile of parts and we're just missing a firing pin, or just got two parts of the gun. And if it's entirely clear that the pile of parts is or isn't a firearm, the district court could decide that as a matter of law in a probable cause hearing. And if there is a chance that it could go either way, then it goes to the jury and the jury decides.
I think, again, that to some extent that begs the question, and there's this antecedent question of how do we know that a group of incomplete disassembled component parts get to the point of...
In this case, we know. The BCA said, oh, we found the two parts we needed, we put the gun together, we fired it at work. So we don't have that problem in this case.
Well, I would say to the contrary, we do have that problem because the BCA had to bring in those two parts. Those two parts were not found in that collection of firearms. There's no evidence that those would be, that those particular parts would be commonly available.
You're proposing a rule as a former defense attorney, 13, 14 years. I advise my clients, okay, from now on, take your gun apart, take one piece and put it in your wife's purse because I don't have the piece. I can't put it together, so I don't have a firearm. I mean, do you see the
certainly
policy problem with what you're proposing?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that that's can be gotten around by the state here. The state's burden of proof is to say that those parts could easily be reassembled and constitute a firearm.
Okay, so then why doesn't that justify this conviction? I mean, you seem to be arguing about a set of facts we don't have here. I mean, I agree with you. If there were this set of facts and then there could be no proof that the gun could be put together and operable, well, that would be a different case, but that's not the case we have here. I mean, we have testimony from the BCA that it was able to find the parts.
To clarify a bit, there was no BCA testimony that the exhibit was stipulated to.
Report.
But yes, the exhibit said, with the addition of these two parts that we produced here in the office, essentially, we could reassemble and test fire the gun. And that's the difference. If there was a BCA agent who said it would have been able to be fired without those parts, or those parts are generally available, you know, or something like that. But we need more to prove that those component parts could be put together. There's no testimony to say maybe they would fall apart. There wouldn't be able to somehow connect these parts without having those additional components that were brought in. I would also mention that the legislature can and will criminalize possession of constituent disassembled components of a firearm when it knows how to do that. And one example is in Statute 609.67, Subdivision 1E defines a machine gun conversion kit as any part or combination of parts designed for use in converting a weapon into a machine gun, and any combination of parts from which a machine gun can be assembled. And it goes on to criminalize that.
If that's how you pronounce that case, Knievel?
Yes.
Court talked about how the legislature does know how to define things, and that had to do with inoperable firearm, and it didn't exempt inoperable firearms, and a disassembled firearm is a subcategory, I think, of an inoperable firearm. The court said the court cannot supply language that the legislature has chosen to omit or neglected to provide.
Right. I would agree that some disassembled firearms are a subset of the set of inoperable firearms. However, as you pointed out initially, this is a different circumstance in which we have disassembled and incomplete. And so while some disassembled firearms fall within that inoperable group, we don't know if all of them do.
To my colleague's point, the person on the other end of that barrel wouldn't know that necessarily that it's missing a bolt.
If it's put together, correct, if it was put together in that way. But if there was just a barrel which was held up, that would be more akin to a crowbar, which, you know, potentially could be used in an assault. But a crowbar is obviously different than a firearm.
But again, why can't the jury sort all this out? Why do we need a hard and fast rule? I mean, given the examples you're coming up with, which are good examples of circumstances where you'd say, well, no, that's not a firearm, why wouldn't we just use the definition the Supreme Court has provided and let the jury decide?
Well, again, there just needs to be that additional piece of testimony to say, as in Knievel, it could still be fired in a different way. To say, as in Cybron, it could easily be reassembled. The state can do that. The state knows how to elicit that testimony. It needs to do that.
The testimony that it could be fired if we've got case law saying it doesn't have to be operable.
Fair enough. I was just referring to the specific facts in Knievel. But the additional testimony to say it could be assembled, that you wouldn't need this particular component in order to reassemble these pieces. In this case...
Sufficiency of the evidence isn't an issue in front of us here, is it? I mean, you're challenging whether or not this gun meets the legal definition. We've been talking about whether the evidence is sufficient because they didn't testify that it could be easily assembled. But that's not an issue that's before us on this appeal, is it?
I raised a second issue, which was a sufficiency issue, but correct to this point, it's regarding
the
definition.
That was on the constructive possession.
Right, yes. Right. Yes, just to clarify. Yes, and so... pointing to the case of Glover, my time's almost up, if I could finish answering your question. As in the case of Glover, in which a flare launcher was determined not to be a firearm because it didn't meet that definition, and there was a definition put forward in Glover, it was found not to be an instrument designed for attack or defense that expels a projectile by explosive force. And so the state essentially needs to prove that it fits that definition, and the state did not do so sufficiently in this case, did not do so. Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Who is appearing for the state this morning?
Just one moment.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. It'll take a minute to hit the button.
I don't have quite the height as my opposing counsel. All right. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lisa Lodine Peralta, and I'm representing the state of Minnesota as the respondent in this case. So I'd like to delve right into this firearm issue. It's what's bothering this court, and it's a key issue here. What we have is serial number R534861. This is a specific weapon. Yes, it's disassembled. It's a Mossberg Model 500C 20-gauge shotgun. It's got serial numbers. It is the shortened stock. Keep in mind here, it's not relevant legally, but this is a stock that a person purposely cut off to make it a shortened weapon. There's a receiver. A receiver is the a major component, as no one would disagree, the barrel. And there's an additional barrel that's also cut off so that the person could use a shortened shotgun. And all of these pieces together, there's no doubt it's shotgun bearing serial number R534861. This is not a pile of pieces of metal or a pile of metal pieces to various firearms. This is a specifically identifiable firearm that doesn't have a bolt and a washer. So the question, I'll just add a couple of these facts to show the state did not prove that the bolt and washer were around. But what I'll note is, if you recall from the facts, this was a backpack located in a van that had many pieces of property, many bags, it appeared to be lived in. It was a very large backpack, sort of a mountain hiking type thing. And the officers, Investigator Gadbois and Investigator Dieter, located these pieces in there. And they did not, they found a firearm to them. So they did not look for, when they were collecting the evidence, this bolt and this washer. They did not I'm not asking you to look at evidence that's outside of the record, but the bolt and the washer could have been in somebody in the, yeah, I'm sorry.
Counsel, I was going to ask a question of appellant's attorney, and I mean, if the argument is, well, you have to prove that the parts are available, can't you do that circumstantially as you can prove other things circumstantially? Like, all circumstances seem to support an inference that appellant had the other two parts someplace because all the stuff was there.
Exactly. And so one of the issues is when you start getting to, well, there's a piece here. Is it a major component? Is it a minor component? Is it set in the other room? Is it, you know, the ammunition is locked away? You know, when you start, this is where it gets mucky when we have the definition that the Supreme Court has said, and that's a definition in light of the legislature sort of standing back and saying, yes, we've read these cases. We know that there's difficulty with this, but we're not going to do anything about it. So we've got this definition that you have pointed to, and it is specific. So I want to try to get more to your point about a jury question on this. So the Glover definition is an instrument designed for attack or defense that expels the projectile. So we have an instrument designed for attack or defense. No, nobody's disputing here that the Mossberg shotgun expels a projectile.
But do you need the bolt to expel the projectile?
Well, it's, again, I'll get to, this is where it's the jury that has to decide if the sufficient amount of it that's there is an instrument that's designed for attack. So if you're walking around and all you've got is the barrel, like the suggestion, you're going to use it as a crowbar, a jury is not going to find that, even though it's derived from an original instrument that was designed for attack and that would expel a projectile, they're not going to say that one piece meets the definition. But it is the jury's job to say, when it's all the pieces minus a bolt and a washer, it's their job to say these are enough that it constitutes the instrument. So,
what would your syllabus point be?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I would agree that it would need to be precedential.
And why is that?
So, because that gets you, as the error-correcting court, into the role of drawing lines that the legislature has chosen not to draw and that the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, you know, is sufficiently met with the definition they have.
So the court shouldn't have weighed in on whether inoperable or not?
No, I'm sorry, excuse me. What I meant to say, though, is you don't need to, in this case, with these facts, add on to the development of the law in regards to inoperable, disassembled, that sort of thing.
Well, counsel, we don't have any law on disassembled. What would be the harm in a syllabus point that said a disassembled firearm may constitute a firearm within the definition of statute? Not that it does, not that it doesn't, but that it may, and that determination is made according to the Supreme Court's definition.
Yes. And Your Honor, I was not remembering at the moment that the Cybrand case was non-published. So you're right. There isn't a binding or a precedential decision from this court on the disassembled.
How are we instructing the jury? Does the jury get instructed, here's the definition of firearm, and it need not be operable? Or does that only come up in a case where operability is an issue?
I do not have the jury instructions that were given in this case memorized, so I can't answer that off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Presumably that's part of the instruction in a case where it is an issue because people would be talking about it.
Right, and there's case law that specifically says that. So,
so if there were a published case saying disassembled may constitute a firearm, it depends on whether the state proves the definition is satisfied. The jury could be told that.
Right. So one of the other issues that I want to get at here is sort of this public policy sorts of arguments. And you guys, I'm sorry, I apologize. Your Honors and counsel have been discussing what the purpose behind these laws and how that may affect what the definition should be. I would like to point you to the language in Knabley, that's how it's pronounced, referencing that the potential use of the firearm by a convicted felon is the concern, okay? And there's also a concern with potential use in the Giertis decision from 1982. So what we have here are convicted felons, and we are concerned with the possibility that they could use a firearm.
Or even display it. What
right.
Tenably says, even if the actual use of the firearm is not at issue, so it can't be operated, its potential use by display is sufficient.
Right. And so,
if you could put this gun together and it still can't be fired, but it would look like a gun to a victim, that's good enough.
Or if you have it disassembled right now, but you can put it together tomorrow to go commit the offense that you want to commit tomorrow. Or if you
put it together well enough that it would be recognized as a firearm.
Yes.
So, counsel, should there have been BCA testimony then about the ease of which this gun was reassembled?
What I will tell you is that would have been great if we had that. It would have made the record that much easier. It would have given the prosecution more evidence. However, we have the evidence in that limited record that it was a bolt and a washer that were added and the gun test fired successfully. And so our position would be that you don't need that. But, of course, everyone on appeal wishes the record below were different.
Why did you need, I mean, it's in a report, right? And people stipulated to the report?
Well, but the report doesn't say, for example, and one of the things appellant is sort of objecting to is whether it was possible. The prosecutor could have asked the BCA agent, can you put it together and hold it as a firearm, for example? Can you put it together and possibly shoot it? Is it possible? Is it within the realm of possibility that without the bolt and the washer, you could somehow fire it? In the Knabley case, it wasn't operable in the traditional sense, but somehow they could maneuver the pieces and make it fire. And so there could be additional evidence from a BCA expert, either that would be helpful to the prosecution or to the defense, if, you know, and that could have weighed on the jury's decision, you know, if they had that expert's, oh, it was really easy. So that's another thing they're talking about in Sybrant. Oh, well, it was easily, could be easily assembled. But one of the things I want to point out, because I think it's important for this court to note that in the Sybrant case, it does not say that every single component was there. The language in the opinion is very specific to say that the major components were there. The other thing that the Sybrant case doesn't say was that it was easily assembled or that it was successfully test fired. Now, there's differences between what ends up in the opinion that you guys issue and what's in the trial court record.
Well, it looks like the closing arguments focused on possession.
Yes.
And didn't really focus on what we've been talking a lot about today.
Right. This legal issue of the definition of a firearm was not really an issue before with the parties and the court. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's because the facts that they had were available, all the major components, no bolt, no washer. There wasn't any dispute about that. And so, you know, the parties and the court were fine with putting it to the jury and letting the jury decide if it was a firearm. They also had to decide, did Mr. Stone constructively possess it? No. But it was not raised as an issue. Now, of course, smart appellate attorneys like opposing counsel are going to raise these issues and questions that they think are important for the court. But I would suggest that a precedential opinion could be very useful to determine, to state that disassembled weapons can be a firearm under the Glover definition. Sort of, that's it. They can be.
And it's a fact, it's an issue for the jury?
Absolutely.
You've got that?
Yeah. Yes. So I believe I will rest on the other issues based on the briefing, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to address two comments that a respondent made. First, respondent stated that the receiver is a major component. No one doubts that. I would contend that that actually is evidence which was not established at the record. There may well be a juror or a group of jurors who don't know what a receiver is. That needs to be established by the state at trial. Similarly, towards the end, and discussing Cybrant, and that's where the term major components comes from, respondents stated that there wasn't any dispute, again, that the major components were present. There was no testimony to that effect, and so that's the state's job.
But we don't have a definition that says that all the major components must be there.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm just referring to those statements.
Right. So that argument matters if, in fact, that's a component of the definition of firearm, and that's not a component of the definition of firearm. We were to make it so.
I'll try to clarify the implication that essentially that jurors know what could be put together out of a group of components. That's an implication which is essentially trying to bring in evidence that's not in the record. That needs to be testified to. Could these components have been somehow put together? Disassembled, incomplete.
Don't we know that? This is what I'm struggling with. We have a report from the BCA that says these components were put together and the gun was fired.
The components were put together with two additional components. If we only knew that there were six pieces of a firearm and we don't know what those pieces are, and we need two additional pieces to have that group of eight pieces and put those together to be a firearm, that's not sufficient. There's no evidence that those six pieces alone constitute a firearm. And that's what I'm getting at. So perhaps thinking of it more generally, a group of however many, six pieces of a firearm, disassembled, incomplete. No dispute about that. No dispute that two additional pieces, whatever they are needed. And together, those eight pieces can form a firearm. We need testimony. The state needs to establish that those six pieces alone can be put together to perhaps still be inoperable to be brandished or used as a firearm.
Why do we need that testimony?
I'm sorry, did you say?
Why do we need testimony that the six pieces alone? Maybe that's what I'm struggling with.
Right.
Why couldn't the law be that you have all but two pieces necessary to put a gun together, the two pieces can be obtained, and the gun can be put together?
Well, maybe there are six barrels, for example. This is my contention.
Again, this is why we have a definition and we let the jury decide.
Yeah, and I would argue that it goes down this slope to saying, are we essentially asking the jury to be experts and to say, okay, six barrels, that's probably not going to put together a firearm. But
that be a motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause? As a matter of law, six barrels can't be put together to make a gun?
Yes, so maybe that's on one far end of the spectrum.
I appreciate the concerns you're raising, but yeah. I think probable cause motion practice will address those concerns, where it is crystal clear as a matter of law that something is or is not capable of being put together as a firearm, and we can weed out those cases and in the
Certainly.
Close calls go to the jury.
Well, perhaps something that might survive probable cause is not going to survive proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I am not a firearms expert. I don't know if a receiver is necessary, frankly, but if we had a receiver and a stock bolt and a barrel, is that enough? You know, maybe
what is your syllabus point? What do you want us to say with all of this?
Sure. My syllabus point is that a group of disassembled, incomplete firearm parts is not or not necessarily a firearm. And I believe that that would go to...
Well, it doesn't saying it's not necessarily a firearm. Isn't that the same as saying, well, it might be a firearm?
I was just going to say, I believe that
that
goes...
Maybe a firearm. We'll instruct the jury and the jury will tell us.
I believe that that goes to your point that it may be a firearm. I would say that there needs to be then something additional that the state needs to...
Okay, that's what I'm asking you. What would you have us add to the definition the Supreme Court has given us?
Essentially, that... The state needs to prove that those incomplete disassembled firearm components can be reassembled to resemble a firearm, albeit inoperable, or to function as a firearm.
That's a fact for the jury?
I'm sorry?
That's a fact for the jury to decide, or is that a legal question?
Well, the state then would need to present that evidence, and the jury, I guess, would determine if the testimony established that the state proved that burden within that added new definition.
May I ask a further question? So, do you agree that the trial focused on whether or not the possession part of the statute was met, and that's why you also wanted to talk about the screenshot that the officer was allowed to testify to?
Yes, Your Honor, if I could have leave to answer. Thank you. Yes, the trial did focus on the possession. There was discussion about, are these components a firearm? That occurred as they were discussing jury instructions. Inoperable was included in the jury instructions, that a firearm can be inoperable, and I think that was, but there was that discussion. And yes, I did want to mention the photographs of the text messages, because that my contention is that required an additional level of authentication. The content of that text conversation required authentication. There was authentication by the officer that these are photographs I took of a phone. However, the content was a conversation between two people, neither of whom testified, a sender and a receiver. There was no identification of who was that contact stored on Ralph's phone. There was no, as far as an evolving area of technology, text messages can be, a conversation can be relatively easily edited, perhaps one or two messages taken out from there. Somebody can use somebody else's phone and send something that appears to come from there. I would briefly point this court to an example within the rules of evidence under authentication in 901B, that I'm losing my sight here, but within that 901 rule of evidence regarding telephone conversations, that there needs to be the rule suggests that there needs to be the phone company showing that the number is assigned to a particular person if the circumstances show the person answering to be the one called. So this is a bit similar, that type of comparison. The circumstances need to show that the one answering is the one called, that contact is the person that the phone company links it to, something like that. Thank you very much. I'd ask this court to reverse and as laid out in the briefing. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. Go ahead and take a moment to get your things set up.
Thank you.
I know, it's making me crazy.
I know.
Or we could just wait a few weeks, and then we'll be back, right? Well, no, we fall back. Because what it's...
Yeah, we fall back.
Forward even from... I know, that's not right on any measure.
Right.
Weird. right, the next case on the court's calendar is the Townhomes of Raspberry Ridge Homeowners Association versus Charles Strupp. Is that how we pronounce it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doing business as Signature Select Contracting et al. And we are ready for...